I'm Jim Hanley, and welcome Dr. Mietnin to this, on behalf of the Journal of Epidemiology, to this interview. As you know, the plan is that the responses you give to the 13 core questions and any amplification of those will be printed in the journal. And I'm hoping the journal will also be generous enough to see the point of maybe making space for answers to additional questions that I have on slightly different topics. But I don't know what's going to happen with that. We're just producing the source document at the moment, and I see the epidemiologist wanting to have a source document to keep. The purpose, as I see it, is basically here to get your views on things that may not be evident or covered in your writings, the extensive writings, and in your addresses to congresses and so on. And also, of course, to put your in perspective your half century of serious work in this field. The half century, by the way, I'm counting, doing the numbers as a good epidemiologist, 25 or 6 of them have been here at McGill University. Right.
Quarter century.
Quarter century.
One third of them.
One third. And at Harvard before that?
From 66 to 86.
See, all right.
Two decades.
Two decades there. Very good. But obviously, looking back, I also want you to look ahead to what you think is in store or should be in store for epidemiology and for our profession. And your advice for the next generation on you know, how young people should prepare themselves for a career in our profession. Okay, so let's start. The first question that the journal wants me to ask is about your entry into epidemiology, but I want to go back to your entry into the world itself. And it's going to be on the web what your age is. You're born in 1936. Okay, so you're coming up on 75. So if you could tell us a little bit about yourself as for nature and nurture, if you know what I mean, and other early influences. And let me be more specific. How much education did your parents have, for example?
My father had his doctorate in theology, of all things.
Wow.
My mother was a teacher, and my aunts and teachers all around. Yeah.
I see.
And so it was a home of education. My father was the head of the high school section of the State Board of Education.
With a degree in, a doctorate in theology?
You bet.
What did he hope to do with it when he got started?
He was going to be a professor, but he got distracted to education.
I see, I see. And how comfortable was your childhood? This was before the war, right? During the war.
I was really born in my conscious age to war circumstances.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
And so we were in the countryside. Father was at war, and it was great.
The father was at war.
Oh, sure.
India.
So it was great deprivation in every way.
Uh-huh.
And then we moved to Helsinki in 1944 when I was 8 years of age.
Okay.
And studied my formal education late in that way.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And there are many siblings?
We are a total of 7.
Wow.
Yes.
Okay. So it was a deprived childhood in the sense of the material.
Oh, very much.
Yeah,
very
yeah,
much
yeah.
So. And further, now that you ask essentially about happiness.
Yeah.
Oh, I did not like the theological environment.
I see.
It was too stringent and limited to my taste.
I see. Okay. Now, others that have been interviewed in the series have mentioned an aptitude or liking for mathematics. I imagine you liked it too, did you? Was it one of your favorite subjects? Or
the
subject to be
mathematics and physics.
Physics, okay.
My teacher of physics turns to the class and says, "You people should take interest in this subject like I and Mietinen do."
Oh,
mathematics. In fact, my first academic endeavor was technological physics, and my livelihood was a matter of teaching mathematics.
I see.
Subsequently, to those who were applying for the technology
school.
So mathematics has been very much a preoccupation.
And not alone that, is it a prerequisite? Serious mathematics a prerequisite for our profession, or are you overtrained in that sense?
I am broadly of the mind that whereas in physics, a physicist uneducated in mathematics without serious education in mathematics is unimaginable.
Yeah, yeah.
But in medical science, to my great consternation, really, you can be a scientist without education in statistics. You delegate such a central thing to a lateral profession.
I see.
That shouldn't be. There should be the integration of statistics with the rest.
Okay. Now, the other prerequisite, I would think, is languages or language. Which languages do you have a good reading knowledge of?
Mother tongue, of course, is Finnish.
Right.
Swedish was an official language.
Yeah.
So one had to develop fluency in Swedish. I did get to be quite fluent in German, which was a good part of the medical textbook's content.
Oh.
And I still communicate in German. Now, French, only a tiny bit of exposure. I liked it, but I did not go deep into it.
But you could read in it?
I can pretty well read professional content.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
I had a teacher come to my house on Saturdays in Boston to teach me French. But then one day I asked, why am I doing this? I was still in Boston.
In preparation for coming?
No, before.
Oh.
And so I, in life, often ask, why am I doing this?
Yeah.
And the answer was vanity, so that in the restaurant you can speak with the garçon. So I quit.
I see.
Yeah.
I see. Which writers have most...
By the way, English, of course, was a major subject
of
study.
Yeah, from early on.
It was a bit delayed because there was a transition from German major to English major, and the textbooks were not available early on. But yeah, I took great interest in the English language.
I know that, yeah. What writers have most influenced your style of your own style of writing, if you have any that you'd want to mention? And in English or in German or any other?
Well, English is what matters.
Okay.
And I cannot say that I developed style from some particular author, but I take a great note of their way of writing, nevertheless.
Yeah.
And I try to improve my writing, but as you know, so often readers say that it is difficult to capture my writing's meaning. But of course the question is, where's the problem? Is the problem in the writing or is it in the reading? Some of these things require a certain level of preparedness to even seriously read. And so I am open to guidance as to how to write better, but I am as serious a writer as anyone that I can think of from the point of view of the flow of the content, the logic of the presentation.
Now, after high school, you've mentioned some of this already. After high school, was there Army service?
Yes, there was.
Which you had to do?
It was compulsory, yes.
And then, so you didn't go directly, you went from high school to Army, and then to...
I went to technology, the technological physics for a year.
Right.
And then I went to the military, and then to medicine.
Oh, okay.
And a tremendous difference between technology studies and medical studies. In technology, you really have very serious studies of very substantive content.
Right.
And in medicine, you just lean back as though sitting in a train and waiting to get to the end station years down the pike.
I see.
So leisurely as for any intellection.
Yeah. But given that, why did you choose medical school and switch from physics? That wasn't your father, was it?
When in technology, I had this thought that whereas as a school kid, I had always been told by others that this boy will be an engineer.
Right.
Because he was so into technology, inventions, endeavors, and constructing things, that it was an outside idea that he is going to be an engineer. And classmates, half a dozen of us, went to technology. Nobody went to medicine. So it was a little bit of thoughtless sort of submission to expectations.
I see. Yeah. But then coming back from the army, you went to medicine,
yeah.
And was that with the idea of being in medical research or being a clinician?
The thing was, and I think it today still is, that when you enter medical school, there is no telling as to what you will do when you grow up.
Right.
There are so many lines of endeavor that I was quite uncommitted, other than I was going to be a physician, practitioner.
You were?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah. But
seeing then individual patients, you mean?
Yeah, but then I was drawn to research as a medical student, and that gave me the impulse to actually do something else.
That's we're coming up now to the first question the journal has posed you, and that is indeed to describe your own path, how your own path brought you into epidemiology, how you went from medicine in general to epidemiology in particular. So might you give us some sense of that?
Yeah, as a medical student, I was drawn into research in a private hospital setting and foundation engaged in cardiologic research. And I got this strong impression that something is fundamentally wrong in this research. That these researchers, medical people from professor on down, while they were concerned with statistics suitably entered into their papers, they had no interest in what these statistics are and what they mean and so on. There was just a way of entering them into your paper like the other papers that you read something. And the
it doesn't change.
And the statisticians would be in an other institute.
Okay.
And they would get the data and produce these statistics to be somehow worked into your article. I thought that this divorce between the substance and the statistics was just inappropriate, wholly inappropriate. And so either I leave academic medicine, which is what I was headed for, or I become a student of these very things. And after some consternation and contemplation, I elected to set out to try to learn theory of medical research, notably applied medical research.
Okay. And then that.
And I was advised then to go and study epidemiology and biostatistics.
In Minnesota?
That was the principle. Epidemiology and biostatistics is what you have to do.
Right.
Now, if you want to do it right, you go to those United States of America.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that.
I see. To the University of Minnesota.
Yeah.
Yeah. To a program which had both epidemiology and biostatistics in the one department? Or
no, separate departments.
Separate. And it was called biostatistics at that point?
It got to be biometry later on. So when I got my PhD, the department was already biometry. It was biostatistics when I entered.
It was. Okay.
Yeah.
Was there extensive coursework and mentoring at the University of Minnesota, or would you consider yourself to be self-taught, if you know what I mean?
Well, let me answer that by saying that once I was done with my education, I took every course in epidemiology and in statistics, biostatistics included, and some lateral courses in genetics and so on. And at the end of it, I had the same feeling as I had at the end of medical school. I have spent this time here studying something, but I have not learned that which I have studied. Medical school, I was officially the top student, but I felt I did not learn medicine. I had my PhD in biometry and epidemiology minor, and I felt that I had not learned the principles of such research as I was concerned with. So that it remained a matter of future development rather than having been
you're
in the band.
You're all ready to go.
That to me is a problem, that education fails to educate.
I see. What epidemiology?
I'm not saying that they were any worse than anybody else.
Right.
Just the
Exactly. Now, what epidemiology textbooks were available to you during your graduate study?
Sort of more advanced book was that of McMahon, Pugh, and Ibsen, 1960, Epidemiologic Methods.
Okay.
Yeah.
And statistics hasn't changed that much, so the
No, not that much. And there was peculiarly then nothing in the nature of epidemiologic statistics, or if you will, clinical statistics. You would have bioassay and you would have sampling theory and things like this, but nothing by way of statistics as it pertains to a certain line of research other than bioassay.
Right, but you did tell me that you were one of the first to carry Mantell's work from Minnesota, where you probably encountered it, to Harvard.
But that was not from my teachings, it was from my studies.
Exactly, but he was one of the first to get into epidemiologic statistics, I would say.
Who was?
Mantell.
Oh, absolutely, in the 50s already.
Yeah.
In the 70s, Mantell said to me that you are the only one who really understands the Mantell-Hensel test. You know that the competitor was the Cochrane test.
Yes, exactly.
But the Cochrane test had a flaw, notably in respect to very thin strata, such as matched pairs, where the error is by a factor of two. So, but Mantell evidently was frustrated with his test being ignored.
Yeah.
And when I came to Harvard, I brought the news about Mantell-Hensel to Harvard.
And you also told me once a conversation you had with Mantell about the reason for the weights in the product, and how it was news to me that AD over BC itself, without any weight, would produce a sum of those over a sum of those, would produce an an unbiased, the median unbiased estimate.
Quite so. But the question is about the weighting.
Exactly.
You agree that his weighting was very ingenious.
Yes.
In that the product grows in proportion to the square of the total. And now you have to divide by the square of the total.
To get it right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Not the square, but the total itself.
And just a footnote on that is that some years ago, Clayton worked out that, in fact, that formulation that he came up with has great theoretical rationale behind it. It's the first iteration on the way to maximum likelihood, it was turned out.
Yes, indeed. So Mantell himself did not quite understand how profound
his
it was.
Instincts were outstanding,
As he would have testified himself.
Oh, yes. He wasn't shy.
No, he was realistic.
Yeah. Now we're coming to the second one, which is the biggest difference between epidemiology that was practiced when you began your career and epidemiology today. What are the biggest differences?
Epidemiology as a concept remains confused as to whether it means practice of epidemiology, which to me is community medicine.
Okay, well, let's start
or epidemiological research.
Right, we'll but start with the first,
But if we want to talk about practice of community medicine, the principal difference that I am concerned with is that increasingly we have this idea around that a citizen ought to take care of their own health in the interest of society. And healthcare increasingly encroaches on individual freedoms. In Nazi Germany, the citizen had the responsibility to take care of their health in the interest of the Reich. And we are in that situation increasingly today, and it bothers me as a libertarian.
I see. Well, I remember when you came to McGill first, I remember you used to smoke a pipe.
Yeah.
You were pretty annoyed at some of the public health laws. Are you talking about tobacco smoking as one of those?
That's preeminent, but yeah. There are other things today, but that is surely the preeminent theme.
Right.
And it was in Nazi Germany.
Yeah, I see. Yeah, I remember in particular the business about smoking in your office. Might I ask how many years you smoked tobacco yourself? I know we shouldn't ask professors to profess about public policy at the same time.
I can't be clear because it's so off and on kind of
thing.
As a youngster and medical student, everybody would smoke in the class,
right.
You believe,
right.
As a medical student.
Yeah.
And so that was part of the environment.
Yeah.
And then once the report came out in 1964, the smoking and health, and my professor quit from 2 packs a day to 0, so did I.
Oh.
I didn't smoke 2 packs, but
I quit.
And so it's been so irregular that you couldn't get a smoking history out of me.
I see. I remember the smoke, the ritual of the with it. But I always thought when I grew up that a pipe smoker was a wise man. And that's what I remember you calling to McGill as, the pipe smoker.
Well, think of Einstein, for instance.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Now, so you gave it up fairly easy?
Oh, sure. Mm.
Now, so you're telling me your smoking history wouldn't really make you eligible for the recent studies and screening for lung cancer then? You didn't smoke that much, did you?
Oh, no. But, again, I don't see any thresholds for eligibility.
I see.
If I were very health preoccupied, I would go and get screened, but I am not very health preoccupied.
I see, because you have a very good opportunity with the collaborators you have. But you never considered it?
No.
Do you think this screening for lung cancer should be covered by our Canadian and our Quebec healthcare system?
This is a question of public policy, mm-hmm. and public policy is not at all my line.
Mm-hmm.
And further, I have the view, and I am not by any means alone in this, that researchers should not express themselves in mm-hmm. respect to public policy. I asked Richard Doll about this, and he had a different view. He thought that a researcher should speak up about public policy, but I am in a different camp.
Mm-hmm.
I have nothing to say as to society should or should not.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you that later. So you don't think it's okay for researchers to be involved in public health policy then?
That's very much my point.
Yeah. Yes, but you spoke of your own professor giving up, and then you gave up. Brian McMahon said the same thing a few years ago about, 20 years ago now, about drinking coffee. He was very wrong, but a lot of people took notice of him at the time. So these public figures do have a chance to influence something and to do it, go wrong or go right. So there's a big responsibility there, I think.
I don't know. It seems to me that there is no moral underpinning to somebody's lifestyle
in
respect to smoking or anything else.
Yeah. The second, that was part one, which is epidemiology as public health practice or community medicine, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then the second one?
As for epidemiological research, since my beginning in epidemiology, the volume has increased enormously. But the question is, how much progress has there been in the achievements?
Mm-hmm.
As you know, today, the remedy for almost everything from the preventive point of view is diet and exercise.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Question, what have we learned about diet and exercise in these 50 years? And I'm afraid not so much. So, volume increase without a whole lot of progress in knowledge. That's my impression
mm-hmm.
about the change.
Along the diet and exercise line, a few years ago you lent me the book by Gary Tobes on good calories, bad calories, and I was very impressed by how extensively you had marked it up and how carefully you had followed his arguments. And I take it that you have pretty high regard for his work, do you?
There are two things here. I was very much preoccupied with cardiovascular disease mm-hmm. epidemiology mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. as I was on my way to become a professor of cardiology back in Helsinki.
Right.
And so I went to these congresses and I followed everything quite closely and was really quite disappointed with, again, the progress. We could constantly listen to three main risk factors in these conferences, but no understanding of why the epidemic was rising and then turned to decline. Very frustrating. Now, when Taubes looks into the topic, he plows deep mm-hmm. historically in respect to matters, epidemiologic, geographic observations and whatever over the centuries. And he delves deep into the biology of atherogenesis and related things. And so the breadth and depth of his scholarship relative to what I think characterizes cardiovascular disease epidemiologists, at least in my experience mm-hmm. in those olden days, this to me was very impressive and to me shows how one should approach cancer epidemiology, for example, really understanding the biology and history rather than just recent epidemiological research. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so Gary Taub, who, by the way, is not a scientist, he's
science
a science writer.
That's right. Yeah.
But he does his work with diligence and depth and mm-hmm. breadth, very impressive.
Now, I asked you about smoking and so on. What counsel do you follow yourself in the area of diet and exercise? I know you're a keen sportsman, but as for diet, does it matter or is it private?
I don't think of diet in my own case
yeah.
from the health point of view.
No, okay.
My aunt taught me that poor people's children are omnivores.
I see. Okay, fair enough. Okay, so let's switch now to the question of which person would you single out as having most strongly influenced your career?
There's no question. As you remember now, I, as a medical student,
yeah.
came to this idea that maybe I should study theory of medical research, and I consulted Martti Karvonen, my professor of physiology.
In Helsinki.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he was the one who advised me to study epidemiology and biostatistics mm-hmm. and to go to the United States to that end. So he is the one person, obviously, and eminently.
And there you encountered, that's where Ansel Keys was, right?
He was another physiologist.
Was he? Yeah. And he's one of the ones that Taubes is not too happy with, I think. Yeah.
Karvonen yeah. collaborated with Keys on this seven countries study.
Right.
And the seven countries study brought us, I think, essentially two themes. Serum cholesterol as something to worry about, mm-hmm. and the Mediterranean diet to think of as the preferable diet. Italy was one of the seven settings in that study.
Yeah.
And again, not a whole lot of progress since
no.
those early days.
No.
But yes, Taubes is highly critical of matters around this and many other matters
yeah.
in nutritional epidemiology.
Exactly. But I did hear you once describe Key's classroom teaching style.
Oh,
and
it
sounds like it was a joy.
Huh? Uniquely impressive.
It reminds me of your own a little bit.
Well, yeah, you are so generous here. But to teach based on your own research is unusual to begin with. But to do that with full presentation of what the critics are saying and answering your critics in class, this is a unique experience to me in my education. So whether he was right or whether
right.
he was wrong
yeah.
is beside the point.
Exactly.
The process was highly academic, as far as I'm concerned.
Are there any persons, one who put you on the path to epidemiology, are there any persons who've strongly influenced your thinking about the concepts of epidemiology and about principles and methods, which has been your own life career? Or again, is that mainly from yourself?
I have to say that the statistics from Mantell mainly surely were very strong exogenous influences. Cochrane also, who both of whom I knew quite closely in those early years. But as for epidemiological research, I had, as a PhD student already, considerable criticisms of what was said by my professor McMahon at Harvard in his book. So that it was clear that the development was very incomplete.
I see.
So I can't say that I have really had strong inputs from epidemiological thinkers.
Philosophers maybe, but...
That's quite another thing. Karl Popper, first and foremost, but many others.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, of course, philosophers can be very misguided. There's been a lot of nonsense.
Now, what have you found to be the most important ingredients of a good collaboration? I know this doesn't apply particularly to you as much as it does to some of the others who have been interviewed, but...
Well, my collaboration has been as a consultant, as an advisor, and in that role, it seems to me that the first order principle should be a deference to your client, your consultee, so that you are a student, a patient student of their own thinking as to what their topic seems to be and how they plan to study it, including really delving into their motives as to why they want to do this. And then again, you patiently, slowly lead them to formulate the object of study in a more detailed and in a meaningful way, and similarly the means of studying it. And I have this idea that ideally, in the end, your consultee would have the idea that they designed the study all the way without anybody's help. So you are there like Socrates, sort of guiding their thinking rather than imposing your thinking.
And with whom have you had the best collaborations then?
I must say with Herschel Gick, the father of pharmacoepidemiology. He was so impressive. Vast knowledge of pharmacology and medicine, for one. Great mastery of his enormous database, complex and voluminous. And commitment to excellence in everything, including making the very best of consultation inputs. And sort of an indication of this was the music that was continually playing in his office. Only Mozart was good enough. So that's what it was, without any exceptions whatsoever. Amadeus, God's beloved, was the only one who qualified. So that was an exercise in excellence and high academia, in my view, more than anything else.
In the research on lung cancer screening that I've alluded to, was your role as more a consultant or a collaborator there?
There was an initiative in the thoracic medicine segment of Cornell Medical at that time, in the beginning of the 90s, where the concern was to find a common theme of research for the different specialties in thoracic medicine. And so they had a retreat in Snowbird, Utah, and they invited me to be an observer and analyst as to what's happening. And so as I had listened to the presentations from the different specialties, I diagnosed CT screening for lung cancer as being their shared concern, and they quickly adopted that advice, and I there already told them that I am not thinking of this in the ordinary epidemiological terms of a randomized trial, but rather as a program of multiple clinical medical questions to be addressed as a complex program, where you set out to do the screening and you develop the whole way of conducting the screening, and then you learn about its diagnostic consequences, and you learn about the prognostic consequences of such novel early diagnosis that you arrive at. So I have been sort of the progenitor of the very idea and its principles, and I have then been an advisor to them again almost 2 decades now.
Mm-hmm. And how satisfying has that role been?
It is a bit of a problem in that there is such a dogmatic epidemiologic commitment to those randomized trials on the mistaken notion that screening is an intervention. And so there is a lot of flack that comes then from the dogmatists. And this, by the way, James, you asked me about this thing on the wall in my office. Students have given me this thing that has Einstein's facade there, and underneath are these words as a quote from Einstein saying, and I am embarrassed to say that because I don't think of myself as being anybody's Einstein, but the words are these: great spirits have always encountered violent opposition from mediocre minds. I cannot help but this comes to mind repeatedly when dealing with the dogmatism of epidemiology in relation to screening, where, by the way, screening in epidemiological thought is thought to be preventive medicine when it is early diagnosis rather than prevention. And so much is amiss around, so that makes me unhappy. But at the same time, the progress of the research has been gratifying. And the people involved with semi-annual international conferences and so on have all been very, very committed.
When you spoke earlier of JIC, you spoke of pharmacoepidemiology. And a number of young epidemiologists that I've talked to, they shy away from pharmacoepidemiology on the grounds that one is too easily corrupted by industry and by government money as well. What would you say to them, these young
people? First of all, I appreciate your question where you refer to students as worrying about corruption by government. This is not very well appreciated that National Institutes of Health in the United States has all sorts of policies emanating from the institutes themselves, such as randomized trials in diagnostics, radiologic diagnostics in particular, cancer diagnostics. So government can be profoundly misguided and misleading, therefore, researchers and industry, of course, is well known in this respect. My view is that I don't care who pays for your research. I care of what you say, what your evidence is. To me, it is totally irrelevant who sponsored your research. The question is, tell me about the research, rather than about the sponsorship.
So, in general, you think it's possible then for epidemiologists and biostatisticians to tread that fine line between truth and money?
Oh no, if there is somebody sponsoring your pursuit of truth, whether it is industry or government, and whatever may be their corrupt ideas bothers me not in the least, so long as you stay on the straight and narrow.
And you think that's possible?
Oh yeah.
I expect that you've been approached many times yourself by lawyers and industry types for paid advice on matters epidemiologic, and how do you decide whether and if you do, which ones to get involved in?
I have Yes. Oftentimes, sometimes half a dozen lawyers come to my office at Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, also here. Including, by the way, tobacco people. No, I don't get involved in these things.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't particularly mind answering questions for them again to make whatever they care to make of. But that's not really their concern. They want you to be in person there in a court of law.
Mm-hmm.
And I just refrain from that totally, have never appeared in court.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I stay out of it.
I see. Now, going back now to another main topic, whom would you regard as the two or three most important epidemiologists during your lifetime?
I take it that the question is about epidemiological research rather than epidemiological practice of community medicine. If I were asked about all time instead of my lifetime,
mm-hmm.
then I would say very obviously Edward Jenner and Robert Koch, the principal epidemiological scientists. But if you ask about my, as you do, about my actual lifetime,
mm-hmm.
then I would say, sort of a little bit uncertain, but I would say, how about Franz Müller and Richard Dahl and Ernst Winger in different roles? Franz Müller, 1939, writes his or publishes his medical thesis and beautifully demonstrates how very high is the risk of lung cancer from smoking. The epidemic was well recognized as being on the ascendancy from the beginning of the century, but for once it was understood that smoking is the explanation of the epidemic. Now, Richard Dahl had a major role in retarding the understanding of this in the UK, and Winger and others in the United States similarly had a role in retarding this understanding. It was only in 1964 that the Smoking and Health Report of the Surgeon General in the United States came out, and even that wasn't all that readily received, so notably my own professor of epidemiology was on the committee, and he was smoking two packs a day, but he said, so long as the committee work is incomplete, I will not change my smoking habits so as to not give a hint of what the results are. Notice, still uncertain, looking to what the truth is. And then when actually the report came out, he cold turkey went from two packs to zero and stayed at zero. But the professor of biostatistics, Pete Behrman, put a poster on his wall saying, it has now been proven beyond any reasonable doubt that smoking is the main cause of statistics. I'm just saying that in the mid-60s still there was this thing. And as you know, your R.A. Fisher spent his sunset years trying to show that smoking does not cause lung cancer. So there was a tremendous slowness in the countries in the post-war period
mm-hmm.
in accepting what was well shown and quite obvious before the war.
You're the first one I've heard to say that Dahl and Winder retarded it. My understanding is that the industry was the one who kept the controversy alive for as long as they could. Why do you say Dahl?
Winder, for instance, in 1950, still concludes that it looks as though there could be an effect, but there was nothing of the sort of obvious major effect in 1950 as published by Winder, for instance. Now, Dole in 1950 was a bit ahead of this, but still not ready to declare that there is a major, major effect on risk of lung cancer. Mm. So that there was, and by the way, he visited Germany in the 30s, Dole did, and knew as to what was going on. And replicating Müller's study would have been a quick thing to do, but no, you get into these very long-term, very massive studies, and you have to wait for years and this and that. It was apparently, as far as I can tell, really a slowing, retarding process. Whether intentional, I can't say.
Yeah, yeah. He did reference, he referenced the German work, I think, indirectly, didn't he? The first paper?
I
think he did.
I can't say, but yeah. It was, actually, the abstract was published in JAMA in 1939.
Oh, okay.
Already.
But I do remember one of the statements there was maybe it's air pollution, maybe it's the tarmac atom, maybe it's this new asphalt we're putting down. That was one.
There were these ideas.
Yeah.
And as you know, the lung cancer topic was being closed in 1964 in the U.S.
Yeah, yeah.
It was remarkably slow. And as I say, my professor was smoking two packs a day.
So we're talking here about epidemiology scientists, as you say, that you regard as the most important. Besides yourself, who do you regard as the most important teachers of theoretical epidemiology? Do you see any others worthy of that name?
Well, I have no notion to the effect that I am the preeminent teacher. I am probably the most experienced. Taught more courses internationally than anybody else. But I'm not saying that I am the number one teacher from the content point of view. But I, again, am not familiar with what the teachings are in the other courses. And so I just don't know who the top teachers in the aggregate are.
Yeah. No, I don't mean teachers in the classroom sense. I mean in the writer sense.
Oh, do you mean developers or textbook authors?
Yeah, textbook authors. Yeah, yeah, that type of teacher. Yeah.
Now, as you would agree, the leading teacher today in textbook terms and even as for coursework, probably clearly is my student, Rothman. As for his teachings in the sense of his writings, I find it interesting that he still has cohort study and case control study, which in my view should be themes of the past. They do not deserve to be presented as modern ideas about epidemiological research. So there is a certain stagnancy there, lack of moving with the understandings.
Now, to come on to your own work, which do you think has been your most influential paper?
This ties up with the very question you just asked. If I need to pick one, it really should be probably that 1976 paper on case referent studies, a citation classic it is. And the eminence of it insofar as influence is concerned is perhaps principally because of the test-based interval estimate concept that was presented there. But I might add, the question there is about under evaluated studies, and I think this is the most under evaluated studies, under appreciated study, really, in that there the case control study concept should have had the beginning of its end, but it didn't. In that paper, it is said as a novelty that the so-called control group really should be understood to be a sample of the study base. And once it is a sample of the study base, which is the referent of the study result, study base is the referent. Why now then you don't compare your case series with your base series? You get numerator information from one and denominator information from the other, and you get to quasi rates and their ratios without any rare disease assumption and all this. So again, to repeat, this is what the world has not yet learned, that the idea of comparing cases with controls is not what really should be done. One should understand that you need a numerator series and a denominator series, and you don't compare them. No, you derive rate ratios from them without any need for rare disease assumption. So case control study should be passé by now. And by the way, confounding, which is the alternative to causation, as you so well know. The Surgeon General's report did not yet have the word confounding there in 1964. But I say, when confounding is the alternative to causality, confounding can never be understood without the concept of study base. If you have case group and control group, and now the question is, what's a confounder? There is no answer to that question. An author of a textbook on case control studies was in my office, and I asked him, hey, how did you define confounding in your textbook? And there was a pause, and then I don't remember. I had the thought quietly that it's difficult to remember something that makes no sense. Case control study is an aberration that really should disappear. And there's something aberrant about cohort study as well. So stagnation prevails also in the theory of epidemiological research.
Just to read into the record here as well, another person who got it right, and that's Barnett Wolf in 1955. Said the same thing, and he's been ignored as well. I mean, he was writing outside of epidemiology, so there's an excuse there. But he, if I go back on his words, they're identical to yours about numerator series, denominator series, and this kind of artifact is avoided if one works with incident rates in the two groups. Clear as day, you know. He uses the funny genetics for small letters for numerators and capital letters for denominators.
And
it's very clear. That paper, though, the 1976 paper, has a lot of material in it, and there are many gems in it, and I think some of them have indeed, I agree with you, some of them have been lost. If you had a chance to do that paper over again, would you do anything different?
Yes. You already say that there is too much in it. So that effective writing really, I think, focuses on component topics one at a time instead of aggregating them the way it was done there. And that said, if I now imagine what really should have been the one and only theme at that time, it should have been this theme of let's move beyond case control study. Let's learn to be students of rates. Let's compare exposed with unexposed rather than cases with controls. And it is not an arbitrary option to compare to one thing or the other. You really must be committed to comparing the exposed with the unexposed as for rates. Comparing cases with controls is nonsense.
That paper also introduced one of the many terms that you brought into epidemiology, and that's the word incidence density. And I asked you recently why you felt the need to invent the term incense density when others like Edmonds and Farr in the early 19th century were already using terms like rate and force of morbidity, force of mortality. What's wrong with something like event rate or transition rate? So do you want to repeat your answer here?
Let's first understand that we are talking about incidence rather than prevalence.
For sure.
Rate.
For sure.
But there is no singularity for incidence rate. There is a proportion type incidence, which is a dimensionless quantity like prevalence rate is. And then there is incidence density with its inverse time dimensionality. So it is a peculiar sub-concept under the concept of incidence rate. And so it needs a term that is more specific. Now, yes, I was, of course, well aware of force or morbidity, which is in that density mode, inverse time mode, no question. But why force? Now you could say force of incidence. Well, does that distinguish between this and the proportion type rate? And why force? I grew up largely, as you know, in statistics, and I have probability density as sort of a model, and in science at large, density is a very common concept. And so now we have incident phenomena, events. Incidence rates are about events, not states.
Mm-hmm.
And so event density is
our event rate.
Well, but in the particular meaning of density, because as I say, proportion type incidence is also a rate.
True.
So rate doesn't cut it with the appropriate specificity. You have to be specific to density.
If I use the word transition rate, it would bring out the idea of sweeping over time.
Transition now refers to the fact that at issue is an event. Event is a transitional event.
Yeah.
But that, when you say transition rate, then I would just as well say event rate. But there are two kinds of event rate, the proportion type rate and then the density type rate in the inverse sense.
Okay.
So I have no regrets about that.
Okay.
But that could have been another paper.
Yes. This term incidence density sampling is used a lot nowadays. What do you think of that?
I have not adopted that at all. Now, it probably has its origins in that 76 paper, but the whole point is that when your study base is population time, a dynamic population time, then you sample that for your denominator series. There's nothing special about the sampling itself. If there's anything special, it is the nature of the study base, namely a dynamic population. So that's what you are sampling.
Yes.
But it's not that you have a peculiar way of sampling.
Yeah.
You sample what you must sample.
Yeah, I have the same
sense. So it's not a sampling option.
I have the same sense that it's a misinterpretation. What other terms did you bring into epidemiology, or is the list too long?
I'm afraid that the latter is the correct answer, but we are here, for instance, talking about comparisons, index category, reference category in the causal contrast, to be sure, is one of these, but...
Effect modification, is that yours?
Well, confounding is not... a novelty of mine, but it was novelty to epidemiology when I introduced it. Of course, I drew it from Fisher as a term.
Yeah.
But in around 1970, still, in epidemiology, there was utter confusion between those two topics of confounding and modification. And I, in response to whatever other piece was topical at the time, I made that distinction between modification and confounding. And those terms, of course, have stuck. But I say again that the on founding is not an innovation of mine. It was established by Fisher.
Mm-hmm. Now, which of your contributions to the field would you most like to be remembered for?
There are people who think about how they are thought of posthumously. I am not one of those. I'm here and now, and I don't care what is thought or said afterwards. But if I should surmise as to what might be the subject of note in those posthumous days of mine, I really think that they would focus on the books that I've been working on for the last 2.5 years, really. Two books just came out, one on clinical epidemiology and EBM, and the other one, a counterpart of the Dictionary of Epidemiology. And right now I'm working on an introductory text on epidemiological research, and I expect to have that complete by the end of this year. And next year I may still produce an introductory text on clinical research, which has been my other preoccupation in addition to epidemiological research. So I think that if there is any attention to the man when he's gone, it might center on these books, which really represent a synopsis of the understandings that I have achieved over the decades now, and focus really on what ultimately matters, namely the elementary. These are not advanced topics, any one of them, they are elementary.
Mm-hmm. Now, the book in particular that I'm struck by is the one, Epidemiologic Research, Terms and Concepts. Is that the right term, the right title?
Quite so.
Yeah. And the arrangement of topics in that book is, to me, very interesting and appealing. And for those who haven't yet bought the book or seen the reviews or looked it up on Amazon, might you give us just a small preview of the contents there and the arrangement?
Yeah. Your questions have already brought up the issue of whether there are preliminaries that are necessary for entry into a line of study. Mm-hmm. For instance, if your study is physics, you surely must have a strong background in mathematics. Now, if your endeavor is going to be epidemiological research, as we know it, now you have certain preliminaries that you need to think about. There is terms and concepts of medicine for one, terms and concepts of science for another, and third, statistics. All these things, ideally, in an orientational way, are in the bag when you enter into your epidemiology studies. And so, in that particular dictionary, if you want to think of it that way, there is a section for each of these preliminaries first. Mm-hmm. And then there is a section for actual epidemiological research. And then there is yet another section for something that I term meta-epidemiological clinical research. There's clinical research that is not of the epidemiological form, and there's clinical research that is of the epidemiological form, and that constitutes the fourth segment. And so I have endeavored to classify terms and concepts in these terms first, and then under the actual epidemiology and meta-epidemiological sections, I distinguish or try to distinguish between topics that have to do with object of study as distinct from methods of study. Because one of my big themes for years and years now has been the inattention in epidemiological research to object design. Everybody is a methodologist, study designer from the methods point of view, without any pride or even thought of being a designer of what to study exactly. And I might add that I have come to the view that the object design should lead you all the way to your statistical model, multivariate statistical model, so that so-called data analysis is no longer a topic I would care to teach, because most of it is covered under object design, and model fitting is today a minor exercise. And so object design versus methods design, an added distinction in those two sections. So it's the architecture that is quite unusual.
Just going back a little bit to another book, to the, your 1985 book, Theoretical Epidemiology, Principles of Occurrence Research in Medicine, what influence do you think it had? And, well, just that for the beginning.
It was not designed to be a textbook in teaching. I never myself, in my extensive international teachings, had that as a textbook, never. So it was sort of an expression of thoughts of the moment, heavy on statistics, for instance, over heavy by far for an introductory text. And so I did not intend it to be used in teaching. I never did that, as I just said. And I don't think that it has had any major impact. But as I said a moment ago, I think these current developments, first of all, they are directed to teaching, and they are directed to introductory teaching. And if they don't have an impact, I will have been a failure. And that's what they will be saying posthumously, that Miettinen made an attempt, you know, around 2010, 12, whatever, but he failed. So no, I don't think it had particular impact.
I'm struck by the what you said to me recently about the book you're planning on epidemiologic research and introduction. You mentioned to me in speaking that the material in this introductory book you're planning could also serve well outside of epidemiology. For example, in areas of research in criminology and psychology, even in other fields. And you seem to imply that the thinking in epidemiologic research was more advanced and more sophisticated than it's in many other fields. Do you want to elaborate a little bit on that?
Well,
did I hear you right?
Yes, quite accurate. Let's take it that insofar as epidemiological research is research into the frequency of occurrence of a phenomenon, as this frequency depends on its determinants in a defined domain. If this is what is meant by epidemiological research, surely that phenomenon need not be a health phenomenon in a health domain. Surely it can be a matter of accidents occurring in highways. It can be a matter of misspellings in textbooks. The occurrence frequency concept, of course, covers a whole lot of any territory, whatever that you care to think about. Now, I am not justified, other than intuitively, saying that we in this health research business that we think of as epidemiological research, that we probably have had a stronger motive and a more serious effort to understand this research than people in linguistics, for example. But I don't know this. I'm just guessing. And I'm rather comfortable with that presumption, but I don't have justification. And so I'm just to agree that a student whose field is psychology, for instance, or criminology, or whatever, that they would do very well, in my opinion, coming to an epidemiology program and learning the ropes about the research in this way, and then going and doing their work in their particular field.
Right. Now, other epidemiologists who have been interviewed for the series, for far other epidemiologists who have been interviewed in the series, the focus has been on what makes for good epidemiologic research and good collaboration and collaborators. But I take it, and it's clear from what we've been saying, that you consider yourself first and foremost a developer and a teacher in the broadest sense of theoretical epidemiology. And So your readers will be interested in what you think makes a good teacher and your own assessment then of how well you've succeeded on this.
Yeah, I am a bit frustrated with the academic culture today where when it comes to teaching, the mantra seems to be effectiveness of teaching, as though at issue were simply how well do you transmit your own understanding to your students. If I imagine myself again as a student in the early 60s, whom would I have liked to have as my teachers? Surely Nathan Mantel, for example, who by the prevailing criteria was an awful teacher, but by my criteria he would have been a deluxe teacher. R.A. Fisher, another statistician, you know, would not cut it by today's criteria, but gee whiz, what a privilege it would have been to be a student of R.A. Fisher. Mm-hmm. I'm saying that to me the key regarding a teacher is for them to master their stuff. They may stutter and they may digress and whatever, but when you have a question, do you get the ultimate answer from this teacher? That to me is the touchstone. And in this way, I have endeavored over the years to really learn the stuff for myself. And then I don't pay a whole lot of attention to effectiveness of transmission, although I have a good deal of experience with that and have come to various ideas as to how to actually bring the student to the threshold of their own understanding. But again, key by far is mastery of your stuff rather than your technology of teaching.
Okay. Before we go on to the next main heading that the journal asked us to consider, I'd just like your views on a collection of different topics. Some of these you may want to say it's covered in one of the two books recently or so on, or you may want to expand here. So in no particular order, these are, I've one under the heading of odds ratios and logistic regression. Let me explain. If I understand you correctly, at one level you think the 2x2 table and the odds ratio should be demoted or maybe even proscribed. And at another level you're saying logistic regression should be promoted to be the single central regression method for all of etiologic, diagnostic and prognostic research. Is that an accurate depiction of your views, and do you see any contradiction in what I'm saying?
Well, accurate it is, and no contradiction whatsoever. Mm. Let me say, when I was starting half a century ago, the 2x2 table was everywhere. And it was a disastrous misguidedness of teaching, where you sample from one margin and you have cohort study, and you sample from another margin and you have case control study, and you sample from the corner and you have cross-sectional study. Awful stuff. And here developed the preoccupation with odds. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, logistic regression, of course, has on the left-hand side the logarithm of odds regarding the outcome event. The theory of logistic regression, of course, is impeccable as statistical theory. It hit epidemiology, by the way, in
1962.
I thought it was 67.
Formally in 67. Yeah.
From Framingham.
Yeah, but he.
But it was based on a discriminant function.
Yeah.
And the maximum likelihood approach came 67 in my mind.
Yeah. Okay.
And so there came with considerable force, and it was a welcome development. But the curious thing is that the case control study topic, once again, if you have a case series and a base series, now the odds, so to speak, is about caseness versus baseness. Mm-hmm. It is not caseness versus non-caseness. It is caseness versus baseness. Mm-hmm. And the logistic model applies to this probability ratio. After all you have in the left-hand side, on the left-hand side, is probability ratio. Mm-hmm. One is the complement of the other, mm-hmm. but it need not be.
That's right.
So probability of caseness for a person moment versus probability of baseness for a person moment.
Mm-hmm.
And now you formulate that logistically fine. There is no odds here whatsoever. If you have two incidence density formulations, numerator entry, denominator, numerator entry, denominator, there is no number of non-cases. There is just the cases and the base size, cases and the base size. And this is what the logistic is about in your etiologic study, and hence no conflict. And we should grow out of this business of reporting odds ratios from etiologic studies. Readers have no meaningful concept to go with that. They ought to learn to say rate ratio.
Yeah.
Rate ratio. That's all it is.
The next one is Bayesian analysis or Bayesian methods and their place, if any, in epidemiologic research. Your succinct views on that.
Bayesian statistics was brought to North America by Savage, having spent his sabbatical with Definetti in Italy. And what I saw Savage bringing more than anything else was the concept of subjective probability rather than so much method. My first class in biostatistics, Professor tosses a coin, successfully catches it, looks at the class, asks, what's the probability of heads? And we all thought 0.5. Wrong. Either it is heads or it is not. There is no probability. The idea that probability in statistics has only to do with relative frequency was very ingrained in statistics, even when in science, probability is a matter of degree of belief. What about the Big Bang theory? Is it correct? You say probably.
Mm-hmm.
You are expressing belief.
Mm-hmm.
That's all over the place in science. In statistics, it's a late idea. But that said, it seems to me that from the methods point of view, from a statistical process point of view, that one should not really say that there is frequentist analysis and there's Bayesian analysis. There is statistical evidence in both camps in the form of likelihood function, as far as I'm concerned. And the duality emerges only in so-called inference, rather than in the methods. So there has been, in my view, in recent years, excessive preoccupation in epidemiology with Bayesian methods. I am not really interested in that topic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Corrections for multiple testing.
Another misunderstanding. In statistics, you have the topic of analysis in analysis of variance, where you actually have a nominal scale determinant, and you have observations in each of the categories, and now you have the omnibus null hypothesis of no difference, any difference among these categories. And now you have component contrasts, and you get different results from the significance testing point of view. And now, therefore, the inconsistencies among the different tests strikes a student of statistics in their statistics studies. Now, the idea that in science we are dealing with this topic when we, in an etiologic study, have several etiologic hypotheses being tested, for example. We don't ever entertain the omnibus null hypothesis. These hypotheses are generally wholly independent of one and other. And the question of how many hypotheses have you tested lately is no proper question to a scientist. If it were a proper question, then how many hypotheses do you plan to test? How many hypotheses have your colleagues tested? This is utter nonsense. And then the Bonferroni correction and so on. You know, statistics ought to stay in its omnibus hypothesis topic and not presume to extend that to science. It's a misunderstanding, profound, serious misunderstanding, rather like sample size determination.
Yes,
one of the awful imports from statistics to science.
Which I saw the other day, the absence of it was considered unethical in a recent report that you and I know well.
Yeah,
it really.
And it is absolutely mindless stuff.
Causal inference is another fad these days.
It is. And if I may be critical about it, I say that there seems to be this dream of a method for moving from evidence to causal understanding inference. You know very well that in a logic there is deductive logic and there's inductive logic. But inductive logic really is almost a contradiction in terms. There is a limited domain for such things, but the movement from evidence to inference on an abstract level, there can never, I suggest for your consideration, be a theoretical methodology for this. It will remain an intuitive realm where no one can come with authority that I have calculated the truth here. No. That's a false dream, in my view.
And the other peer review itself and the whole process. Again, I see from your from your reaction.
Look, it's one of those things that it's like democracy.
Okay.
That we suffer democracy and we suffer peer review well aware about the pain in it. And in particular, I have this view, and by the way, when I peer review, I never say to the editor, don't publish. I present my critique, and I present that not only to the editor, but to the authors as well. And you go and make whatever you care to make of this. So again, there should not be censorship. Mm-hmm. And in particular then, if somebody has something extraordinary to say, it is quickly weeded out from the literature by peer review, which is really stuck with the prevailing paradigms and does not tolerate deviations from it. Related to this issue of decisions about publication, I have said it in my 85 textbook already, that decisions about publication should be taken without the results being at hand. As you well know, today publication acceptance highly dependent on what your results are, rather than how worthy your topic was and how well designed your study was. And this is a built-in bias. But yeah, I have no improvement for the peer reviewing itself other than I wish others would do what I do. Present your thoughts, but don't block publications.
Okay, so that was a set of topics that the journal hadn't asked about, but now we move back to ones they have. And they've asked, although I don't think it applies particularly to you, on how you choose the research topics you want to address.
What I can say is that I do have ideas as to how people should choose them, okay, even if I am not in the process of choosing.
Right.
And there, the beginning of all wisdom, in my view, in epidemiological research, is that it should not be driven by investigator interest. Cut out all talk about investigator interest. Society pays for the research, and it does not pay for the researcher to indulge in their hobby. No, the society wishes to have worthy results from your work toward public health, and therefore one should be concerned with what is worth studying from the societal point of view and at the same time feasible to meaningfully study. And so again, it is a matter of object design in these terms. Now, when I was a PhD student, I for a while entertained the idea of writing a thesis in epidemiological research. And I was already then thinking this way. What is it that people really would like to learn about from epidemiological research? And whereas common ideas at the time, like today, are all prevention of cardiovascular disease, prevention of cancer, I thought that people probably would appreciate the focus on the upstream topic of rate of aging. If only people would know what in their diet serves to slow down aging, biological aging, they really would take note of that, and they would probably act accordingly, the other gender in particular, but all of us. And therefore, research on a rate of aging, really, I felt then, and I feel today, is an example of a well-chosen topic. Question is, though, do you know how to do that? And notably, do you have a way of measuring people's rate of aging?
Individuals.
Yeah. How do you classify somebody as being a slow ager, somebody else as a fast ager? You have to be able to do that. Otherwise, you can't do the work. And so I thought about that, and I thought I had the solution as to how you can develop an index of rate of aging. I, in fact, published that later in some other context. And so I thought that it was feasible and worthwhile. And be that as it may, people may or may not agree with me, but my point still is that one should not be driven by one's interests, nor by opportunities, but by a sense of purpose. That the work is there in the service of public health, and it is feasible to validly, meaningfully conduct. Mm-hmm. So notice I'm opinionated even if I'm not involved.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm curious how what idea you had and how it might be, the rate of aging might be measured. It's not telomere length or anything like that, is it?
That's probably too sophisticated.
Yeah.
But there are a number of physiognomic features that show aging. The one that even has the term to that is presbyopia. Presbyopia refers to old, aged eye.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, how was it in high school? Did you have glasses then? And then, what is your current? Just an example. Mm-hmm. What was your height at that time? What is it now?
Mm-hmm.
Measures of skin
simple things. Then.
All sorts of things are there, including, by the way, arguably, your facial appearance.
Of course.
Now, you have all sorts of indices, but that's not the point. That's the beginning. Now, the added thing is that you have somebody's chronological age.
Mm-hmm.
So now, first phase is let's estimate chronological age on the basis of these things.
Yes.
And now for an individual, you have their estimated chronological age and their actual chronological age. And their ratio speaks to the rate of aging. Mm-hmm. So the beginning is estimation of chronological age. And if you can do that, then you have a rate of...
I'm going to share with you later a study on twins from Denmark that was published a couple of Christmases ago on exactly that. And people are very good at working out the difference between chronological...
Just the impression?
Just from photographs.
There's
some beautiful work from Denmark, I think it is on this. Yeah, and it was impressive. So now turning now to matters outside of epidemiology, what have you been your major interests outside of epidemiologic activities? I know sports one, but more intellectual things, I guess.
I have sort of led on that parallel with epidemiology or epidemiological research, I have always had a keen interest in clinical research. And so the meta-epidemiological clinical research topic has been an explicit professional preoccupation.
Right.
But apart from that, all along, considerable interest in matters intellectual, whether in science or in technology, and in humanities as well. And even in our monotheistic and other religions, because the evolution of ideas over time in its respective categories is a theme that really interests me, and I would of course hope that in epidemiology we would have a faster rate of evolution of ideas than we have had, and in clinical research, just the same. We are excessively conservative in that way. So, themes like this, and then, of course, reading extensively, including most recently, for instance, David Deutsch has this wonderful book, The Beginning of Infinity. He is a polymath, physicist. He's an engineer in quantum computing, and he is preoccupied with what it is that makes for human progress or progress in human societies. And he is a great aficionado of Bronowski, that you know, the ultimate polymath, mathematician, playwright, inventor. Book author, the author of this wonderful book, The Ascent of Man. And recently, most recently, just a week ago, I read through Neil Ferguson's book, Civilization, The West and the Rest. And the big theme there is what is it that has made for the ascendancy of the West over the last half millennium? And there are six pillars there, and medicine is one of them. And so I was particularly interested in how he sees the role of medicine in the ascendancy of the West, or Western civilization. But that gives you a sense of what the preoccupations are lateral to epidemiology.
Yeah, yeah. The one other one that you didn't mention, it's lower down probably in level, is Malcolm Gladwell. Where you mentioned in
I have read his books.
But what impresses me about him is how normal his English is. You know, the words don't get in the way at all. He's like a guy you meet in the bus that you talk to. His style of writing is very
earthy
and accessible and so on. And I'm wondering.
But his writing is not really on scholarship.
Absolutely not.
He is writing for the lay audience.
Yeah, yeah.
And the thing is that he makes these observations.
Yeah. So you think for those other types, the Niall Fergusons and the, the others, they need to have
a scholar,
and they have to write at a higher level. Okay.
Now Bronowski arguably wrote for the general audience, as you know, it was a television series and so on.
First, So he
he's sort of intermediate there. It seems to me.
Now, in your opinion, what's been epidemiology's most important contribution to society?
Oh, well, there's no question. Ascendancy over communicable disease. Mm-hmm. Communicable disease control. This is what Ferguson actually only, this is the only feature of medicine that he brings up.
Yeah.
The
and of course it's in the word epidemiology that we have as well, right?
But he does not use the word epidemiology.
Does he not? Yeah.
Nor do epidemiologists today, when they define epidemiology, they don't think of practice of epidemiology.
But I'm thinking of the epidemics and the community.
To be sure. To me, it is amazing that we don't have today the concept or practice of epidemiology. In my introductory book, upcoming, that I'm working now, I deal with, among other things, with the public health office of the city of Ottawa and how evident it is from their work and their language and their reports that they are practicing epidemiology for the population of the city of Ottawa. But we academics, we have lost sight of practice of this community medicine, which is really amazing. You have noticed perhaps that a very small hole is somewhat difficult to discern, but if a hole is enormous, it's also difficult to see.
Yes.
And we have enormous holes in our perception of issues before us in epidemiology. Prime among them is failure to think about practice of community medicine.
Now, your assessment, what would it be of the current state of health of epidemiology then? What are the biggest risks and opportunities?
Again, if epidemiology means practice of epidemiology, then you have one answer. If it is research, it's another answer. Now, I have no problem with today's practices of epidemiology other than what I mentioned earlier in this discussion.
Our liberties.
That we have really gone too close to the Nazi society, where society dictates how the individual conducts themselves in respect to health issues. But as for the research, public is ultimately what we are supposed to be in the service of. And we supposedly then conduct research so that the public ever better knows how to preserve their health and how to promote their health and whatever they care to think about in respect to preventive medicine, which is what epidemiology really is about in the community sense. Now, people read mostly about nutrition, which is the first order concern. And they are very, very bewildered by the conflicting, changing ideas that come from epidemiology. And further, some of the topics get to be almost sort of laughter-provoking. And so we really ought to tidy up this whole operation of epidemiological research, notably as for what comes to public attention. One of the remedies, in my view, would be that there should be no press release, not from a university nor from a journal, of a current paper published. Only reviews deserve public attention. And that would help us a great deal. But we, for some reason, have two big egos there in universities and in journals so that they tout their most recent.
Our own university has a press office for exactly that purpose.
It is just unfortunate that this is so. But somehow we ought to be able to convey to the public the impression that we're doing useful work toward their health. But they haven't seen the progress, I'm afraid. And so it worries me.
Yeah. So those are the risks and the opportunities for epidemiology in the state of...
Well, I don't think of risks to begin with, particularly. Although I worry about young people who set out to do case control studies for the rest of time without any real sense of what to study and how to study. But as for looking into the future opportunities, I feel that there are an enormous amount of opportunities in the meta-epidemiologic realm in particular. That is, the development of the knowledge base of clinical affairs, knowledge base appropriate for expert systems, codification of diagnostic probability functions and others, and there's a way of getting that information from those experts, as I explain in that book on clinical epidemiology. So I would be thrilled to be a beginning researcher today and engage in these efforts. One can see productivity down the pike very securely.
Tied into the information age that we're in now?
Very much the beginning that practice ought to be driven by expert systems rather than by inspiration and subjectivity.
Now, do you have any predictions about what the future might hold for our field?
I have quite a strong sense of that, actually. Epidemiology has been in the service of public health and subservient to public health all along, and will continue to be in this role. But public health has profoundly changed in recent decades without public healthers always noticing, which is amazing, one of these enormous holes again. Public health used to be community health, community medicine and the paramedical activities in the community, public health, because that was the only public domain in healthcare, the community domain. Clinical medicine was business outside government.
Public in the funding side of it?
Any side. Being a bricklayer, being a surgeon, from the government point of view, they were in trades. And we have nothing much to do with those. Clinical medicine was extrinsic to government concerns in all essence.
Right.
Government was concerned with community health.
Right.
Medicine and non-medicine community health, community medicine included. But then came national health insurance. And now clinical medicine became an element in public health. Public health had an enormous expansion.
Publicly funded healthcare.
Indeed.
Yeah.
National health insurance is about public funding of medicine, meaning clinical medicine, which was not previously publicly funded. So now public health is principally by far about clinical medicine. A minister of health is preoccupied with clinical medicine.
That's right.
And preoccupied with one feature of clinical medicine overwhelmingly, namely cost.
Yeah.
And now, therefore, whereas politicians and economists have been trying to find solutions to this problem that is already bad and getting worse and will always continue to get worse and worse, solutions are needed. Question: do epidemiologists have something to bring? They have not really brought anything of note yet, I am afraid. But I think they really have to get on with this topic, this new topic of public health. And there, what are the roles? The first role, I think, would be one of being the diagnosticians of the ills of healthcare, clinical healthcare overwhelmingly, meaning wasteful proceedings there. Diagnosing these, bringing these to the attention of the relevant decision makers so as to liberate the system from waste. This is not science, but it is very important public health work in today's public health. But the other thing then is the one that I just mentioned, namely that epidemiologists should be there in the front line of making clinical practice expert system driven. It takes epidemiologists to work with clinicians to produce those systems and thus bring everybody really to professionalism in the practice of clinical medicine rather than this individual decision making and contemplation. You know very well from the epidemiology point of view that the lead idea in this direction has been that of Cochrane, Archie Cochrane, that if only practitioners knew what treatment works best, they would all use the best or most effective treatment, and the National Health Service of UK would now be more efficient if only doctors knew better. Mm-hmm. And so his solution was cultivation of randomized trials. I start from the same problem, and I say if only doctors knew what the most illustrious colleagues think and do, they would do likewise. And again, waste would be avoided, and costs would come down, and quality would improve. So I am basically suggesting a role different from Cochrane, but a larger role, something whose results are more quickly and less expensively attainable.
Do you hold any promise for, do genomics hold any promise for the maintenance and promotion of health, or are they just a big fad?
There has been, as you know, a huge promotion of the idea that solutions to problems of health come from genetics and proteomics and so on. The mapping cost was $3 billion, and now the question is, so was it worthwhile? You know that the genetics work thus far has been very frustrating in two ways. First, that when you are looking for a genetic determination of illnesses, the ability to find major genes has been very frustrating. Perhaps it's not the question of ability, but the existence. The existence. So that the idea then of genetics-based remedies, I think, is much less promising now than it used to be. Let me just quickly, apropos, if I may, say that I went to my class reunion, medical school class reunion, and a colleague of mine, a molecular biology expert for Europe, a German professor now, he said that in the 70s a book came out delineating what innovations basic science will bring to medicine in the next 20 years. And he says, we are now 20 years into the future, and I'll tell you about the realization of those promises. The long and short of it was very short. Nothing has materialized. And I have a certain fear that this genomics topic is not different. That when a quarter century now this question is raised, what has been the innovation in medicine from this source, I am afraid that it's not going to be very laudatory in respect to the prognostication.
Except as sort of personal genome-wide scans for individuals that they won't know what to make of when they get the answer. There will be some of that.
When I bought my first car in Minneapolis, the car dealer, for some reason, was prompted to say that there are two things over-advertised in America. The American housewife and the Mayo Clinic. I don't know.
Where is it coming from?
But as for today's over-advertising in the health business, I'm afraid that the genomics enterprise is in that category.
Well, let's not be negative at the end. I want to hear the most important piece of advice you could give to a new epidemiologist starting a career. And I imagine you're positive about it.
I am very sanguine about the idea that somebody who is suitably programmed, so to speak, will have a very good, promising career in the sense of the societal yield for one and personal satisfaction of accomplishment for another. And as I study the history of ideas, as I indicated, I am very much a student of, there's nothing like the phenomenon of enlightenment, how it changed thinking and was the platform for progress in science and consequently in societies at large. So it's good to recall what the maxim really was of enlightenment as perpetuated by Immanuel Kant, the philosopher, for example. And it was, as you probably well know, sapere aude. Sapere aude was the maxim of enlightenment, meaning dare to reason or dare to think for yourself. So it's this business of being an independent agent rather than merely a perpetuator of the past, as was the idea before enlightenment. That would be the beginning. But then there's this other thing which perhaps is worth mentioning. I grew up, as you know, in cardiology in medical school, and subsequently even I had a long-term cardiology appointment, in fact, in Boston. But in any case, I was consulting with Paul Huguenholz in Erasmus University early on in the 60s already. And on his wall would be this...
Who was he?
Paul Huguenholz, cardiologist. He was in Children's Hospital at Harvard, and then he was recruited to Erasmus, the new medical faculty, as being the showcase department there. Okay, so on his wall, I can read, make no small plants. They have no magic in stirring men's blood. Make no small plants. They have no magic in stirring men's blood. So a certain ambitiousness has to be there for accomplishment in the arts, in sports, and so too, let's be clear, in science. If you don't have ambition and self-confidence in ability to achieve vision and results and achieve end results, then I don't think you really belong. So you have to have the daring to dream big dreams, and then the sort of creativity to get to the particulars and the tenacity to pursue the goals. But once you have the philosophical orientation, it seems to me that the future for a young, today's young epidemiologist is very good, whether looked at from the outside, the societal point of view, or from the inside, as for their career satisfaction.
On that very inspirational note, I want to thank you on behalf of the readers and viewers, I hope, of this interview. So thank you. Thank you again.
Thank you for all the insightful questions.